Shu jo mu hen se gan do bono mu jin se gan dan ho ma mu ryo se gan ga ku but se ro
Today I'll be speaking about wisdom and compassion, the ideas of wisdom and compassion in Buddhism, and in particular the Zen perspective on them. Then there'll be a chance for you to ask any questions, make any comments you want to at the end. So wisdom and compassion, as you probably know, are a kind of fundamental to Buddhist teaching as regard to what human beings are encouraged to cultivate, their mind, to cultivate a mind of wisdom and compassion. And the question is, of course, what are wisdom and compassion? And the definition I'd like to give, based to some extent on the Zen perspective, is that wisdom is to see things clearly, to see the way things are, and compassion is to act with all beings and all the universe in mind. So not coming from one's own personal place, but from with goodwill to all beings in the universe, not just humans. And from a Zen point of view, so all Buddhist traditions would say that we must cultivate a mind of wisdom and compassion. We must cultivate wisdom and compassion within our mind. But different traditions maybe speak differently or place different emphases with regard to how we do this. And in particular, I would say that there's kind of a difference between what I would call an active cultivation versus a passive cultivation. And an active cultivation is where one attempts to cultivate actively a particular mindset. In other words, one tries to be wise or tries to be compassionate. So I'm using language which maybe is slightly, maybe not quite the exact language, but effectively that there is an active attempt to arise wise mind, compassionate mind, to feel compassion towards other beings. The famous practice is the Metta Bhavana practice, where one actively tries to feel a sense of compassion towards oneself, towards those one loves, and towards what those one feels neutral to, and towards those that one maybe feels hatred towards. So one tries to cultivate a sense of loving kindness and compassion towards all these beings in the universe. So there's an active attempt to cultivate that within the mind. And similarly, with regard to wisdom, there might be an active attempt to behave in a wise way, to not do something that's unwise and behave in a wise way. And that's not really, that's one kind of side of things, and that's not really the way that Zen does it, because Zen is very much influenced by Taoism, that Zen comes from the encounter between Buddhism and Taoism. And from a Taoist perspective, we aim to cultivate naturalness. We aim to cultivate a sense of natural arising of one's own being. And so from a Zen point of view, we wish to allow to create a mind in which wisdom and compassion naturally, unconsciously and automatically arise. And so that is really the kind of Zen perspective on it, is that rather than trying to be compassionate, trying to be wise, we create the space in which compassion and wisdom arises. And so, as I said, we tend towards this more passive cultivation rather than more active cultivation. Having said that, it's my personal belief that, and it's different for different each of us, but there are some things that we maybe have blind spots around, particularly difficult challenges. And in those cases, maybe we need to face up to the unwise things we do or the uncompassionate things, and actively need to try to stop it. So being aware of them, first of all, is important, but maybe sometimes for us, we need to actively try to cut certain behaviour patterns. So Zen tends to focus more on the natural arising, but sometimes we do, if we see a particularly unhelpful pattern in ourselves, in our behaviour, in our mind, we attempt to, when we see it, attempt to actively cut it. And that's a bit like, in some ways, if you think about, for some of us, so some people are able to drink alcohol and not become drawn in. Others maybe have a more of a tendency to get drawn in, and maybe and so have to be completely teetotal to avoid being drawn in into alcoholism. And it's the same way that each of us has different aspects of ourselves, maybe which we find it harder to deal with. And so in those cases, maybe a hard cut is necessary. But that's not the general attitude. The general attitude in Zen is that we cultivate a space in which compassion and wisdom arises. And of course, for us, that means Zen practice, as, with regard to what we've just done. And that Zen practice, from a Zen perspective, is the natural cultivation of wisdom and compassion. Because from a Zen point of view, wisdom is to see clearly, and compassion is to act with other beings in the mind, act with all beings in mind in our actions. And so to see clearly, through the practice of Zazen, we can see the games that our own mind plays more clearly. We can see the ways in which our own ego asserts itself. And I would say that everyone's ego asserts itself, but each of us, our ego asserts itself in different ways. All of us have mind demons, but some of us have different mind demons from others. And so it's very much both a absolute sharing, in that we all share this same nature of mind, but also it's very personal, in that each of us individually faces different demons in our lives. And so the idea is that we become aware both of the general games and of our own personal games. We see the way that these games plays out in general, and we see the way that they play out in us personally. And that insight, which is not necessarily a knowledge thing, not necessarily a thinking thing, not necessarily even a conscious thing, but a more natural engagement with the way that the mind works, allows us to, again, not necessarily consciously, not necessarily analytically, have some insight into the games that go on in other people's minds as well. And so not only do we see that these games play out in our mind, but we see them playing out in others' minds and in others' lives. And because we see them playing out in our minds and see them playing out in others' minds, we can see that what goes on in someone else, we can have compassion for what goes on in someone else. We can have compassion for the mistakes they make, the suffering they cause themselves, the suffering they cause others, because to a greater or less extent, we do the same. That's the thing. So we might do it in a different way from the other person, but at a fundamental level, we make those same mistakes, or we make the mistakes in the same way, and we cause suffering to ourselves and to others because of the way that our ego asserts itself in our, and so we have compassion for ourselves and others by seeing that what goes on in us and what goes on in others, even though at a certain level it's different, on another level is fundamentally the same, and so we can find compassion in that. And so that comes from the practices of Zen, seeing the games that go on in our minds. The other aspect is, so I'm often, when I've spoken before, I've spoken about how we have both the relative perspective and the absolute perspective in Buddhism and therefore in Zen. The relative perspective being that some things are, in some sense, better than others. Some things, when we suffer less, when others suffer less, that is better. When there's more suffering, that is worse. The absolute perspective is that at a certain fundamental level, all this suffering is simply a manifestation of constructed reality. Even ourselves, from a Buddhist point of view, are a manifestation of constructed reality. So ourselves, at a certain fundamental absolute level, have no fundamental absolute truth, no reality. And so we live in the art of Zen practice is to live with both of these realities, the fact that things do matter, but things don't matter. It is important what decision you make. Even the smallest decision has an importance, but at a certain fundamental level, there is no importance. And it's living with that tension, between the relative and the absolute. And so neither, and this is what the Shinjin Mei says, neither getting completely pulled into the relative and therefore feeling that everything is so important and feeling that we have to do, so if we are living a compassionate life, feeling that we have to, that every single decision we make is so important that it hurts us. Or living completely in the absolute, where we are so aloof and distant from human existence that nothing seems to matter. And the Shinjin Mei says neither of these are the reality. The reality is that we must live with both of these at the same time and try to cultivate that in us. So Zazen faces us with both of those. We see the games that our mind plays, and we also see that when the mind lets go of its conceptualization, its thinking, there is some place beyond which is cannot be put into words, which we taste through the practice of Zazen. So we taste both the relative and the absolute in Zazen and cultivate it. So wisdom is effectively, from a relative point of view, knowing ourselves and knowing the games that our mind plays, and also, therefore, having some insight into the games that other people play. And as I said, this knowing is not necessarily a conscious and analytic thing. It's not the same as necessarily a psychotherapeutic process. It's more of an intuitive, spacious sense of awareness and noticing. Sometimes it is very conscious. Sometimes it's, there's that kind of thought again. That's one that gets me into trouble. Other times it's more intuitive and less put into words. And so the relative aspect of wisdom is knowing ourselves better and seeing that we share that with others. And the absolute aspect of wisdom is seeing that at a certain deep level, those thoughts are have no fundamental reality, have no fundamental importance. And also seeing that that is shared with other beings as well. The fact that other beings also have access to, for want of a better word, Buddha nature, the quiet place beyond and behind thoughts, which we encounter through Zazen. And everyone tastes it at times through beauty. There's moments when the mind just drops away, the thinking just drops away, and there's a sense of absolute awe in the face of reality. And so everyone tastes it, not only people who practice. And so we don't separate ourselves from all beings. So that's wisdom. And so compassion is that because there is this fundamental sharing, there's a fundamental similarity between us and other beings and a fundamental difference, then we can see that all beings share this simple feeling of being that comes behind thought, but is expressed in diversity. Diversity based on our experiences, our karma, the bodies we're born into, the culture we're born into. All those things affect the way that it's expressed in our individual. And so we can have compassion and respect for those who are different from us, and those who have different strengths but also make different mistakes from us. And so we can have compassion for them and see that at a fundamental level we are all equal, even though we're expressed in a different way. And so at a fundamental level we share something, but on the other hand there is this universal diversity. And we can also see that all of us, one of the things that we share from a Buddhist point of view is the drive to be free from suffering and pain. And so we can see in all beings this drive to not suffer. And we can be aware of that. And part of compassion is to see that even in people who cause harm in the world, quite a lot of harm in the world, people who we fundamentally disagree with, we can see that at the root of it, there is a desire for them to free themselves from suffering in some way. They might be manifesting it in a way that is both unhelpful for them and for those around them, but that desire is still there. That trying to free themselves from suffering is often still there. So we can have compassion for that, even when we fundamentally disagree with who they are, what they stand for. We can see that there is something to be compassionate about. The other thing to say about compassion is that compassion is not the same as empathizing. That example I've just given, where it's someone who we maybe see causing suffering in the world and therefore have almost a desire to stop, in someone who's maybe racist or whatever, you know, that we want to actually strongly resist that, but nonetheless we can see that there's something in them that's searching for peace, and that's causing some of the harm that they do. So we don't necessarily empathise. Compassion is not the same as empathy. That's one of the key things. It's not necessarily about feeling the feelings that the other person is having. Compassion is about seeing and being aware of what's going on. And one of the images that's used in Japanese Buddhism is that the Bodhisattva Compassion Kanon is represented as having many, many eyes and many, many hands, many, many faces and many, many hands, so that they can see all beings. They're not focused on just one being, but they see the bigger picture. And so rather than seeing one person and feeling, oh, I really want to help that person, they're suffering, there is a sense of that person in a bigger context. And so we don't necessarily need to be drawn in to that person's experience of suffering. We can have a certain amount of stepping back. And so we can, as a result of that, we are able to respond more appropriately in the relative world to the suffering in front of us in a wider context. And when I say suffering, it might be anger. It might be that it might be expressed as anger by that person. It might be it can be expressed in many ways. But we can hopefully aspire through the awareness that comes through practice to respond more appropriately, not from our place and not from a place of necessarily just wanting to make them happy, but wanting to heal collectively what's going on in society, in the world, in the cosmos. So we respond appropriately, and that responding appropriately does not necessarily, again, mean thinking deeply about it. It might mean something emerges and comes out in the situation, and if one's own ego is let go of, then hopefully what emerges in response to that situation will be more appropriate and more healing to everyone involved. It might be, we always have to act, and we all have our personalities, we all have our own egos, etc. And so it might come subtly from our stuff. It will come from our stuff. It will come from our personality. That's inevitable, because we are all born with our... So it will come from our stuff. We do our best in the situation, and we just notice how it responds, how it lands in the collective community. Does it result in suffering for self, for other? Does it result in suffering reducing? And that's really the test of action, and being aware of whether subtle suffering arises or disperses is one of the tests of how did that action fall. And so we just simply allow ourselves to be open to the feedback that the universe gives us, and try not to respond by egoic closing off when things come our way. So the other thing to say, and is that one of the reasons why in Zen we emphasize this kind of passive cultivation of wisdom and compassion is because effectively we want to allow space for it to arise in the other. And also we need to be honest with ourselves and with others as well. There is a risk, particularly when people are in teaching situations, that the collective projections from people who are, if you like, students of Zen, that the teacher can not even necessarily consciously, but be put into a position where they feel they always need to be wise and compassionate, if you see what I mean, and be without mistake. And so my feeling is that one needs to be, and then one can start actually fooling oneself. This is true also of, isn't only teachers, but it's anyone who's, one can fool oneself. One can lie to oneself about compassion and wisdom in one's life, feel that maybe one's doing better than one isn't. And so without judgment, it's necessary to always let go of any sense of, well, in fact, without judgment, it's necessary to let go of any sense of judgment, effectively. It's necessary to be aware, but without judgment, of what goes well and what goes less well in terms of the way that actions emerge from oneself and spread out into the community. And so be willing to accept feedback, whether it's consciously given by someone or whether it's given in more subtle ways by, for want of a better word, the universe. If you see what I mean. So whether it's just coming to, whether it's someone's getting irritated with you, or there is just something that's just moving not so well in the community. And be aware of the tendency to put ourselves on a pedestal and other people to put us on the pedestal. Be careful about that. And so there's effectively, there needs to be a sense of humility to see that we are, in fact, to use Dogen's expression, we are a dewdrop reflecting the moon. So we are merely a dewdrop. We are not an ocean. We might reflect the moon, but we are merely a dewdrop. And so not to feel that we either are perfect, nor to feel that we need to carry the weight of the entire world on our shoulders. It's not something that is just about us. It's about all of humanity, all beings, all of existence. And so it's not our job personally to save all of the universe, even though that's what we chanted earlier on. Beings numberless, I vow to save them all. But as I think both Adrian and myself have spoken about the vows, it's a deliberate koan, a deliberate paradox, that we vow something that is, even in the way it's worded, impossible. You see what I mean? So we vow, and that's because we must see ourselves as part of a greater whole, and we play our part in that greater whole, and allow ourselves to connect more broadly, widely. And so I think in the West in particular, there's a tendency to heroic individualism, and that's something that we need to let go of through what we do. And see, it arises even in people with the best of motives, and in fact the press kind of encourages it, in that if there's a story about something good's happening, the press likes to find someone with a nice backstory that they can have as the kind of figurehead for that good thing. And so We need to sort of see that all of these things arise collectively, even if it channels through one person and then outward. I mean, Greta Thunberg, she's a wonderful person, but it's not only about her. You see, she might was a catalyst, but it's not only about her. You know, that's that sort of thing. There is a sense of the desire to have a hero, and then that hero inevitably will either burn out or let us down in some way, and so we must also make sure we don't put ourselves into that position of the heroic individual, and see that from a Zen point of view, wisdom and compassion is a collective endeavour, not an individual endeavour. Yeah. So part of that is giving space to others. And Suzuki Roshi, someone asked him about what is the means of being compassionate to others? And he said, give people space and watch them. The teacher's job is actually to give people space and watch them. And I think that applies to all of us. So it's not about necessarily jumping in to sort something out, but allow space, to allow people space to sort their own place in the world out to some extent. Nancy, one of the founders of the Zen Center and my first teacher, I asked her once about, okay, what should I do to help others? And her response was, leave them alone, which is not always a bad advice. So I'll finish there. Thank you all for listening. We'll finish. We'll chant the vows again. So we'll do it. I'll say Shigo Segonmon. That's the introduction, and then we'll chant the vows.
Shigo Segonmon. Good.